All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William P. Green, Chief Judge presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. You may be seated.
Good morning. I'm joined on the bench by Judges Hagel and Judge Davis to hear the matter of Fournier versus Shinseki. Are counsel ready to proceed? Would counsel for Mr. Fournier please state your name for the record?
Tom Falsino, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, I have difficulty hearing, so would you?
Tom Falsino.
Paulatino?
Paulsino.
Paulatino.
Paulsino.
P-O-L-S-E-N-O.
Okay.
And with me at counsel table is Glenn Bergman.
And for the government?
Good morning, Your Honors. Justin Zimmer on behalf of the Secretary. With me today is John Moriarty, Deputy Assistant General Counsel.
Very well. Mr. Paulsino, do you, who's arguing?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay. You have 30 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal? Is that 30 minutes?
We reserve 10 minutes, Your Honor.
10? All right. Are you ready to proceed?
I am.
You may proceed.
Excuse me, Mr. Paulsino. Could you adjust the microphone so that, I mean, so it captures your voice as well as possible?
See what we can do. All
right. So you don't have to lean into it. Don't.
How's that? Good. Morning, Chief Judge Green, and may it please the court. I'm here on behalf of Richard Fournier, who was discharged from the Navy in 1965 with what was called a personality disorder. Over the years, he applied on several occasions to VA for compensation for a psychiatric problem, which was eventually awarded. The question for the court today will be whether Mr. Fournier's August 1971 formal application for what he called a nervous condition was appropriately responded to by VA's regional office at that time.
Now tell me, was that 71 application one for reopening, or was it a, are you contending that it was a separate claim?
Well, it was filed on VA's formal claim form. So to all appearances at the time, it was a new claim.
But it was for a condition that he had previously claimed?
Using the same name, yes, same condition.
All right.
A nervous condition.
Counsel, what exactly about the October 1971 RO letter is problematic? What is not clear?
Well, the letter says that Mr. Fournier had been denied compensation for a nervous condition earlier, which was not a considered not a disability within the meaning of the law. But in essence, what he had actually been denied compensation for was a personality disorder, which actually was not subject to compensation, but that was not what he was claiming. He stated in layman's terms that he had a nervous problem and he was asking for compensation for whatever that problem was, whatever symptoms he was suffering. And it was simply false as a matter of law for the RO to say that is not a disability. So
a nervous condition at that time was compensable?
Yes, Your Honor. Not strictly according to the words nervous condition, which don't appear in the rating schedule. But there's never been a requirement for a veteran to plead with specificity a certain diagnosis from the DSM-2 or 3 at that time or according to the rating schedule.
But in 1965? When he filed his original application, was that for nervous condition?
It was.
And he referred to his service records?
He did, Your Honor.
And the service records have him being discharged for what?
Immature personality, Your Honor.
Okay.
Can I ask you to clarify something? The 1971 claim, did it either attach a document to it or referred to the record, maybe both? The first question, which Chief Judge Green asked you, which I'm not sure I heard the answer to, is, was this a claim to reopen, or was this a new claim that you were filing? I'm sorry, that Mr. Fournier was filing?
Well, it was a new claim for the same condition.
Okay.
It could have been interpreted as a claim to reopen.
Well, and why do you say it's a new claim if it was based on exactly the same material as it was as before?
Well, I would hesitate to call it a claim to reopen unless the claimant asked that his claim be reopened or asked for reconsideration of an earlier claim. That would be more straightforward. What we have here is a new claim on a new form.
So if an individual were to, let's say, be denied, and the individual came, we're talking about 1971 now. So if an individual were, his claim were denied, and the next day he came in and said, filed the same documents, and then how would the VA have to treat it?
They would have to give him adequate notice of why they were going to deny the claim.
Even if they'd done it before?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, that's twice. Now he files the same thing the next day. What, does the VA have the same obligation? No matter how many times the individual files the same piece of paper?
Well, I suppose there's a limit in reason.
When would that be? How would we determine that?
I haven't found any legal authority that pins it down. All we have is references in the M21 manual to how to handle a duplicate claim, which I think is what Your Honor is thinking of.
Well, it doesn't
same
say
claim over and over again.
It doesn't say duplicate claim, does it, in the M21-1? Those words don't appear, do they?
They do appear in the supplemental authorities issued by the Secretary last week, Your Honor.
Okay, I'm sorry. I may come back to that.
So, Counsel, let me make sure I understand. This is a new claim and involving nervous condition. Your position is that somehow the RO got it wrong when they indicated that it was a duplicate of a claim that he had submitted in 65 or so, some point in the 60s. Is that correct?
Well, we're not going to challenge as a matter of fact that the second claim was a duplicate of the first one.
Mm-hmm. You're not going to challenge that?
But not as a matter of fact. It essentially, it says the same thing.
All right. If it says the same thing, wasn't the law at the time as it is now that if you have been disallowed a claim, that claim will not be considered on the same facts?
Well, that was the law as to how to adjudicate the claim, but the law as to how to respond to the claim under Section 3.103.
Well, if it can't be adjudicated on the same facts, then how can you provoke the requirements for the normal process for acting on an original claim?
Well, there's still a requirement.
Since you don't adjudicate.
There's still a requirement to communicate with the claimant, though.
And wasn't there a notice to the claimant that because it is a duplicate of the previous claim, it will not be adjudicated?
The point we're pressing is that the notice was not true. It gave statements that were simply not true.
Well, what new? What,
but there must be some base.
Was there a different evidence submitted with the filing in 1971?
Well, with the new filing, appellant just referred to his records and attached a document referring to his personality.
Those were the same records that were
before the RO.
All right.
In the initial claim.
Okay.
So, where I was going with this was, did the appellants, I mean, if there's some problem with the ROs, well, let me make sure I understand, Counsel. So, you are not contending that there was a problem with the RO's decision other than it didn't properly communicate the basis for the decision to your client?
There's a lack of adequate notice under Section 3103 and 3109, Your Honor.
A lack of adequate notice regarding
for the RO's decision.
Okay.
And of appellate rights and the time limits for filing appeal. So those come before the actual adjudication. So the contention is not that It's not a claim, for example, to revise the October 1971 action based on clear and unmistakable error or something to that effect. The contention is that that action is not adequate for finality to attach because the RO failed to give adequate notice of the reasons for its decision at that time because it informed Mr. Furnier that what he was claiming was not a disability, a nervous condition, which is not true, and that the RO could take no further action on his claim, which is not true, because had he submitted new material evidence, had the RO told him that he could, had the RO explained the actual reason for the denial, which is essentially that the record showed a diagnosis of only personality disorder, and that the RO needed evidence of an acquired psychiatric disorder in order for compensation to be paid, had he been told that, the actual reason, the legally permissible reason for the decision, then he could have responded in a way that would have moved his claim forward. Instead, he was given this letter, which simply says, what you're asking for is not a disability. We are not going to take any further action on your claim.
Okay, I appreciate that clarification because I was going to ask why your client didn't submit a Q request, but I think your response addresses that.
Okay, I'm back. I'm looking through the M21-1 manual provisions, and I don't see the word duplicate. Can you point me to that? I may have missed it. I'm not saying it's not there.
Section 46.02,
right,
which was cited in the principal brief, as an example of a substantive rule that would force the RO to issue a formal rating decision.
Where is that word?
Under 46.02B, there is broad language to the effect that if the record contains any information that a veteran believes the condition is related to service, it becomes a claim requiring formal rating and notification of appeal rights. But that also refers to Chapter 27 of the M21, which the Secretary has recently served. In Chapter 27, Section 27.07, there is a reference to duplicate claims. There is language.
That was what section?
27.07, Your Honor.
Okay.
And in this section, there's language to the effect that when an application, a formal application, on Form 526, such as the one Mr. Furnier filed in this case, is based upon the same conditions for which a claim was formally disallowed and new material evidence is not submitted, the veteran will be informed that in view of the previous determination, it will be necessary to deny the claim. That's section 27.07.
Would you read that again, please?
When such an application, in reference to VA Form 21-526, is filed and based upon the same conditions for which a claim was formerly disallowed, and new and material evidence is not submitted, the veteran will be informed that in view of the determination previously made, it will be necessary to deny the claim in the absence of changes in the law or regulations.
Okay, so what's different then?
Well, this
says in the absence, right, of, did I hear you correctly? It says in the absence of the provision says in the, that the only, the, if he files the same claim, doesn't say the word duplicate, if he files the same claim based on the same basis, then the obligation of the VA is to tell the individual why it was denied before, the way I hear that. Now, have I misinterpreted that? And go ahead, if you could answer that question.
Counsel, let me just clarify. Are we talking about 2707? Is that the site you referenced for 2702?
2707, Your Honor.
Okay. Which is labeled duplicate claims.
Which is labeled duplicate claims.
Okay. I'm sorry. I apologize for that.
This presumably was the basis for the RO's action in October 1971. Strictly speaking, it says...
Well, let me go back. It says that the individual will be informed of the reason the claim was previously denied. Correct?
It says, in view of the determination previously made. A reading consistent with Section 3103 would be...
Well, the veteran will be informed that in view of the determination previously made, it will be necessary to deny the claim in the absence of a change in law or regulations. Now, doesn't that mean that all the individual has to be told is, hey, we denied your claim before, this is the reason, and whatever else they say, in the letter?
According to this provision, yes.
Okay.
But this provision is not consistent with Section 3.103. So the court should focus on 3.103, 3.109, laying out basic due process rights to notice, rather than this new M21 provision. These provisions are almost internally contradictory. If we look to 26.0, the first paragraph before this one, 27.06C, it actually says that a letter from a veteran merely asking for reconsideration and not constituting evidence, new material evidence, upon receipt, the veteran should be fully informed of the kind of evidence which would best promote his interests.
Now, okay, you just said it's not a request for reconsideration. You just, in response to Chief Judge Green's question, you said it was not a request for reconsideration.
Correct, but here, even a letter.
A letter that what?
Not even a formal claim.
A letter that what? Please read that again.
A letter from a veteran merely asking for reconsideration
Asking for reconsideration, right, of the previous claim. And
that's
you
right.
Just told Chief Judge Green this is not a letter asking for reconsideration. So how does that apply?
So, well, you mean that I said it was a new formal claim?
No. Well, I think... My recollection that Chief Judge Green asked you a question said that, is this a letter requesting reconsideration? If not, I'll ask it. And I believe your response to that was no. Am I correct?
You're correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Then why does that provision apply when it is limited, sounds to me the language is limited, to a request for reconsideration of a previously denied claim?
Well, I think the best answer is that the correspondence received from the claimant should be construed sympathetically in a manner that favors him, according to VA's regulations and its guidelines. And instead of taking that tack, the RO chose the least sympathetic reading they possibly could of this new application.
Yeah, but you're okay. Didn't the statute said if you submit an application that doesn't have new and material evidence with it, right, after you've been disallowed, it would be considered a duplicate claim?
The M21 provision, yes, Your Honor.
And then the statute says that a claim that's been previously disallowed in the absence of new and material evidence will not be considered.
I believe it's
on the same facts.
I believe it says will not be granted on the same facts, something to that effect, which I would take to come after the question of whether notice has been given to the claimant of the reasons for denying it. So again, I'm not saying the claim could have been granted, but that Mr. Fernier should have been told why his claim
could
be
granted. A different reason than the previous reason, if it's the same facts.
Well, he should have been given the actual reason, whatever it was.
It's a duplicate claim.
Correct, but I still think he should have been given the reason for the denial.
Okay. And so if he didn't, you're maintaining that what?
If he didn't...
By not getting it, you're suggesting that that claim is...
By not giving him the notice, the RO's action was not legally permissible. And not the kind of action to which finality would apply.
Okay, so the claim would be still pending?
Still open and pending from August of 1971.
Till?
Well, the current effective date is April of 1980.
Okay.
So it would be earlier than what he's been granted so far.
Okay, and so he didn't submit any evidence in 71. So what evidence in 71 would establish his entitlement to that benefit in 1971?
Well, from the perspective of deciding whether service connection was warranted, the VA would look to the entire record. At the time the claim was submitted, there was no evidence to support it. The contention is he should have been told that, the actual reason why his claim couldn't be granted, so that he understood what he had to do.
But he never submitted any evidence until 1987?
1980, Your Honor.
1980. Well, he submitted an application in 1980.
And pointed to his hospitalization around that time.
So what evidence do you have showing that he had this mood behavior in 1971?
The only evidence at the time of this application was in his service records, pointing to his personality disorder.
Is that the same thing?
The same
thing. Personality disorder is the same as the mood behavior?
Well, he's claiming a nervous condition.
Okay.
Whatever that meant to him as a layman, that's what he's trying to be compensated for.
But you're saying that he should get benefits for perhaps something that he's not yet acquired? I mean, he had medical evidence showing that he, in 1987, had a mood behavior.
Well, we have medical evidence suggesting that his current problems related back to a head injury suffered while he was on active duty. So if the 1971 claim was open and pending, VA would have to decide whether at that time his symptom, what was diagnosed as a personality disorder, was in fact a manifestation of his head injury. So there is evidence in the file as a whole referring his problems all the way back to active duty. That's why he was granted compensation eventually. So I wouldn't say that even if the claim was open, it couldn't be granted, such that it wouldn't matter. It could be granted. It could be granted all the way back to service if we could find an open claim going back that far. But the best basis we have now is the August 1971 claim, to which inadequate notice was given.
Thank you.
Good morning again, Your Honors. Justin Zimmer on behalf of the Secretary. Your Honors, the Secretary's position is that the Court should affirm the decision on appeal for several reasons. First reason, Your Honors, is the Secretary's contention that the VA has complied with 38 CFR 3.103 by providing the veteran, in this case, notice via the October 1971 letter. Additionally, Your Honors, the Secretary's position is that the VA complied with the relevant M21-1 provisions, specifically Chapter 4602, taken in reference with Chapter 27, particularly Chapter 2702 and Chapter 2707. Your Honors, the appellant, in the Secretary's opinion, the heart of appellant's argument is that he did not receive a rating decision in this case. He did not receive adequate notice. And again, it's the Secretary's position that the October 71 letter did provide that notice.
Counsel, let's take a look at 4602 for a second. Of the M21?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me get it for you. I'm looking at, there are two sections on that provision, Section A and Section B. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. There's also a Section C that does not have any substantive language to it.
Right. And Section B is entitled Reconsideration by the Rating Board.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, you indicated that the VA complied with the M21 provisions. Are you suggesting that this was a reconsideration?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the Secretary's position that, you know, in this case, the veteran submitted an application in 71, attached additional evidence, and when that application came into the RO, the VA's adjudication manual took over, and there was an initial determination made as to what this application was. In this case, Your Honor, the adjudication clerk looked at it and determined that it was an attempt to reopen and funneled that analysis into 4602 and 2707. And that analysis resulted in the fact that the VA's determination that this was a duplicate claim, as that term is used in 2707, and that there was no other action that the VA could take at that time. So yes, Your Honor, it's the Secretary's position that this was a claim for reconsideration under the guise of a claim to reopen.
Okay. And as I read Section B, there are a number of eventualities that could lead to a reconsideration. The first part of Section B discusses new and material evidence. The second part discusses evidence showing an entitlement to increased benefits. And the third part, I'm not really clear on what that means, but it seems to suggest that if the veteran believes there's a condition in the record, then that becomes a new claim. Again, I'm not clear on what that means, but is there any inconsistency between the M21 provision and the regulations in effect at the time, 19-110?
Well, Your Honor, 19-110, I believe, is taken in conjunction with 3.103, essentially says, I'd like to step back, Your Honor. 3.103 talks about giving notice, providing notice, providing the procedure for appealing the decision and the time limits for that appeal. 3.103 must be taken in context with 19-110, which essentially says that the failure to provide the discussion regarding appellate rights and time limits, that failure does not extend the time for a veteran to appeal.
So if the veteran doesn't get any notice, it doesn't matter. Is there some fundamental unfairness implicit there?
Your Honor, that was not briefed by the parties. However, I would say in this case, Your Honor, specific to this veteran, factually, there is no unfairness. In this situation, this veteran applied for benefits in 1967, was denied benefits, and was presumably provided. There's no issue. That issue has not been come up in briefing as to whether and what he received. It's presumed that he received the adequate notice, including appellate rights, at that time, in conjunction with the issuance of a formal rating decision. So, Your Honor, the Secretary has researched that question as far as the unfairness. 19-110, the Secretary's research reveals, was done away with in 1980. It was in existence from 1965 to 1980. And the Secretary has not gleaned any reason why it was done away with. There is a case, Your Honor, the Secretary has uncovered, where the court discussed the fact that 19-109, I believe at the time, said you had to provide appellate rights, and there was an ambiguity between that section and 19-110, and that was the reason that precipitated that section going away. In today's terms, Your Honor, of course, appellate rights must be provided in conjunction with this issuance of a formal rating decision. But we're talking about 1971 versus today.
I understand. Is there a... Is the Secretary's position that the provisions of the M21 are substantive rules or guidance?
Your Honor,
or interpretive guidance?
Your Honor, the Secretary's position is that the M21 manual, specifically the provisions at issue in this case, are interpretive. They're guidelines for the VA to follow. Your Honor, if we look at the scheme at the time, 3.103 speaks of notice. There's no other discussion of what that notice means. The VA implemented its M21 provisions in order to determine what notice must be given in various situations. In situations, this is not a situation where appellant filed another claim for nervous condition and attached new documents, referred to doctor's letters, etc. That's what he did in 1980, and his claim was treated differently at that time.
So based on the M21 and 19110, in particular 19110, which basically says the failure to receive notice does not extend time periods within which to reply. Something along those lines.
Correct, Your Honor. And side issue of that point, Your Honor, is the fact that appellant in his brief has not challenged or taken issue with that failure. Right. So, Your Honor, the issue in the Secretary's mind is this, going back to this issue of notice. And, Your Honor, the Secretary's position is if the notice was adequate, this decision was final. It was a decision in response to an application. The decision was final, and any attempt to challenge it now would have to be in the context of Q, which in this case appellant has not alleged.
I understand. I'm trying to really kind of pin down the what I perceive to be a conflict between the M21 and 19110.
Okay.
And if in fact there is a conflict between the M21 and 19110, if M21 is interpretive guidance, then the regulation that went through the requirements of the APA's notice and comment would be obviously valid. So, and there's a section in 4602 that basically says that if the record contains any information that the veteran believes the condition is related to service or to another service-connected disability, it becomes a claim requiring formal rating and notification of right of appeal in the event of an adverse decision. And I was trying to reconcile that with the facts here and with 19110. Can you provide any guidance on that?
Sure. With respect to the 4602B argument, that last sentence, it's the Secretary's position that sentence has to be taken in view of the entire M21 manual, particularly in this case, 2707. The Secretary does not issue formal rating decisions in response to every single application. And, Your Honor, the Secretary's research reveals that is still the case today. There, unfortunately, are just factual situations where a veteran will submit multiple applications. Over time, within a few weeks period, there has to be a procedure for responding to those situations meaningfully. So as to your first question, 4602B question, Your Honor, that's the Secretary's response. As to the, if I can go back to the conflict, the perceived conflict with 19110.
Right.
In this situation, Your Honor, again, there's no conflict. An appellant is only alleging error based on failure of notice, not on the failure to receive appellant rights or time to respond. So to the extent that there is perceived conflict, that is not even an issue in the Secretary's mind in this case, Your Honor. That was never raised by appellant again.
And the letter contained of 1971, then your position is that provides all the notice that was required for that additional submission.
Correct, Your Honor. Well, ideally, it would have contained the appellate rights information and the time to appeal. That would happen today. However, Your Honor, that obviously didn't happen. That was not ideal. Appellant's not challenged it, and the Secretary's position is that letter as a whole was still adequate and valid based on the fact that 19110 was in existence. So again, the Secretary's position is there's no conflict here in this case. Maybe in another case, there may be. The Secretary can't envision that set of facts right now. They're not before the court right now, Your Honor.
Okay, I understand. Did the Secretary receive any pleadings from the appellant? Maybe pleadings wouldn't be appropriate, but any letters or documents or communications from the appellant after the decision in 1971?
No, Your Honor.
To your knowledge?
To my knowledge, based on review of the record, there was no communication with regard to a nervous condition or a psychiatric claim until 1980. Okay. And in 1980, appellant submitted a statement in support of claim where he specifically references treatment in VA hospitals in support of his claim. And at the time, Your Honor, the Secretary treated that differently. They did not deny it as a duplicate claim. Factually, that was distinguishable again from 1971, where he merely attached his separation from service document, noting an inadequate personality. So 1971, he receives a denial. Nothing happens for almost 9 years, or 9 years until 1980, when he submits additional evidence in support of his claim.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, if I may
under 70, under 7104, I think it is. I've mentioned this several times today, and that is, except upon the presentation of new and material evidence, the claim that's been previously disallowed will not be considered again on the same facts, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
If such a incident occurred now, you would say that an individual who received a disallowance and then 2 years later submitted that same claim again with no new evidence, would that fall under 7104, such as the duplicate claim?
Well, Your Honor, 7104 deals with finality, correct, Your Honor? It's the Secretary's position today that the claim would be funneled similarly based on VA's adjudication manual. Your Honor, let's step back again. Today we still have 3.103, and it talks about notice and requirements. It's in large part similar to what was in existence in 1971. So again, the claim would come in. In this case, if this were to happen today, Your Honor, the VA would administratively deny the claim, but they would inform the appellant with regard to what was needed, new material evidence, and they would also provide appellate rights. And that's based on the M21 provisions. And
so you would still provide appellate rights to allow him to appeal to the board to argue that he should have his claim adjudicated even though it's on the same facts?
That would be his right, Your Honor. Correct. Whether or not that would prevail.
So the 7104 bar, if you will, is res judicata, doesn't have any effect. I mean, you could still litigate the question.
Administratively, Your Honor, however, if it were to get to the court, the Secretary would suggest that the rule of finality would come to play. And the court would determine whether new material evidence had been submitted. And if it had not been, then the claim would be final and would remain denied.
Presuming that somehow the 71 application remained pending until 1980. Would it be your position then that if it was pending, then he would be entitled to effective date of 1971?
If it was somehow pending, Your Honor. However, in this case, the Secretary cannot envision how it would be pending because it was...
Let's just say I said it was pending. We ruled that there needed to have been that notice, and therefore a failure to provide that notice kept that application open until there was a decision, and the decision was made in 1987. And then what effect would that have on the effective date? Would he be entitled to benefits back to 71 based on the evidence?
No, Your Honor. Again, we're talking about a nervous condition and inadequate personality. It's a personality disorder. It was not compensable under VA's rating schedule at the time period. So whether even if you were to say, as Your Honor says, it was pending, the result would not change. It was not a compensable condition at the time.
Well, VA granted service connection.
Correct.
What changed it from a nervous condition to something else?
The evidence, Your Honor. And that evidence was not of record until 1980 onward. That evidence simply was not in existence in 1971. Appellant did not point out any additional evidence at the time. That development in 80 was precipitated by Appellant's own discussion of his treatment, referring to doctors and locations. The VA developed that and ended up granting service connection for a mood disorder. That's different from what was at play in 1971 in the Secretary's mind, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'd just like to go back to a kind of a big picture question regarding the legal effects of the M21 provisions.
Sure.
And you addressed my question regarding the particular provisions at play in this case. I suspect you're familiar with the case law in this area, cases like Fugere and Haas and Cohen and Diamond and all those, where there have been some provisions in the M21 that have been held to be substantive rules without notice and comment, as far as I can tell. And so I'm not sure how effective a substantive rule can be a substantive rule without notice and comment, but that's a matter for another day.
Yes, Your Honor.
Generally, would the provisions in the M21, from the Secretary's perspective, constitute guidance or substantive rules?
Generally, Your Honor, they would constitute interpretive rules.
Okay.
As the Federal Circuit and Haas acknowledged, that is the Secretary's position.
Okay. There may be particular circumstances that lead to a different conclusion based upon it. On the provisions of the M21 and the presence or absence of a regulation, I assume, but...
Correct, Your Honor. After analyzing the cases the court cited in their December 9th, 2009 order, it seems like in the Secretary's view, the body of case law with regard to substantive, where M21 provision was found substantive, dealt with the grant or denial of a benefit or a decrease of a benefit. Hearing loss, for example, VA attempted to reduce benefits where the veteran's hearing loss had not changed by rescinding an M21 provision. That provision was found to be substantive because it benefited the veteran, and that is factually distinguishable from our case, where we're talking about a notice provision, which is specifically provided for now in statute and regulation, at the time in regulation only.
Okay. Aren't there requirements? I mean, a way we're supposed to analyze whether something is a substantive rule or an interpretive rule? I mean, it just doesn't... We just don't say one's an interpretive and one's a... substantive rule because it exists in the M21-1 or somewhere, OGC opinion or something, right? What is the analysis that we would have to do? And under this, the provisions of the M21-1 in this case.
Well, Your Honor, the cases that talk about substantive versus interpretive, there's not necessarily clear-cut analysis. However, again, by looking at the case law where the M21 provision has been found to be substantive, that provision was found to narrowly constrict the VA's authority to act by limiting situations or limiting how they acted in response to an application, whether it be a PTSD claim or a claim for school benefits. Those cases deal with, they say, VA, this is how you need to act. In contrast, Your Honor, with regard to the M21 provisions at issue in 1971, those provisions interpreted 3.103 with regard to what notice means. And they left open a wide array of possibilities on how VA could respond. One possibility was to consider the claim duplicate and issue an administrative letter. One possibility would be to issue a formal rating decision and provide notice to the veteran via letter also, Your Honor. So again, in this case, the Secretary's position is that discretion was left open to VA to act.
Well, let me ask you this. Assuming that this is the proper way to analyze this, let me ask you a few questions. Is there a conflict, or is the first step of analysis whether there's a conflict between a statute or a regulation that's been formed by notice and comment? In other words, if there's a regulation or if there's a statute, let's take a statute that's clear and it doesn't provide some statement in the regulation and the VA will issue regulations with regard to this. Then don't we stop right then and there on our analysis about whether or not the M21-1 is a substantive or a interpretive regulation?
If there's no conflict,
Your Honor? No conflict.
Correct, Your Honor.
Now, in 1971, I know that the requirement for VA to to comply with the APA was the requirement was in effect only brought as a matter of law in 1988. And prior to that, at some point, the VA voluntarily adopted the provisions of the APA to apply to it. Did that occur before or after this claim? In other words, did the APA refer bind the VA, or did the VA volunteer to accept it before or after 1971, or before or after the M21 or 3.103 or 19.110 were issued?
Your Honor, the parties have not briefed the issue. However, the Secretary's research reveals that Section 3.103 was amended in 1972, where it was entitled Due Process, and also discussed the notice that it previously discussed. Based on that fact, Your Honor, the Secretary's impression, without having briefed the issues, would be the APA, to the extent your question, would apply back to 1972.
Okay, so then this would refer to regulations also. So we wouldn't go to the M21-1 unless there was some sort of ambiguity in those regulations, the regulations that apply.
Correct, Your Honor.
Now, do you see any ambiguity or authority to issue further regulations in those in 19.110 or 3.103, I think it is? Is there any ambiguity that needs to be dealt with?
Your Honor, not for purposes of this case, the Secretary's position. I understand, I believe I understand where Your Honor is speaking to. However, to the extent there's ambiguity, it deals with the failure to provide appellate rights and the time limits. Your Honor, that's just simply not at issue in this case. We're speaking specifically to notice. 3.103 talks about notice. The M21 provisions deal with how notice is provided. That's the ancillary aspect of 19.110, Your Honor, in the Secretary's position, does not come to play in this case. Again, it may come to play in other cases.
Okay, so 3.103 is the only place we look?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And so we wouldn't even go further to then look at whether or not the M21-1 provisions meet the requirements for a substantive rule? So we don't even get, in your view, we don't even get to the M21-1. Is that correct?
Correct. If the court were to conclude that notice was adequate under the language of regulation, we would not even have to deal with the M21 issue at all.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, may I briefly sure. conclude? Your Honor, again, it's the Secretary's position that the court should affirm the March 4th, 2008 decision because VA complied with applicable regulation. And if the court were to find it did not comply with regulation, the Secretary contends that the court can look to the M21 procedures, which the Secretary contends that the VA complied with. Finally, Your Honor, the Secretary would like to point out to the extent the court were to find error, we need to look to the fact that the condition claimed in 71 was not compensable then, nor is it compensable now. Therefore, the rule of prejudicial error would come to play. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. So that I understand completely, you said if one claims nervous condition, that nervous condition itself is determined not to be compensable?
Based on the facts of this case, Your Honor, nervous condition,
which looks like personality defect,
and is supported by documents in the record that discusses an inadequate personality. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, with regard to Mr. Fernier's correspondence of August 1971, it is, as in any case where a veteran sends word to VA that he wants compensation, it's simply a request for money. It's a request for compensation. It's not a formal claim. It's not a claim to reopen. Not a claim for reconsideration. Those labels are applied by VA in adjudicating the claim later. VA applies its expertise to determine what to do with the claim. The intention is the same. And Section 3103 suggests when that claim, fair claim, fair intention to request compensation comes in, that in every case, the veteran gets notice. And that notice is reason for the decision, the actual reason, notice of appellate rights, and notice of the time limits to file an appeal. On or about 1959, VA took upon itself the obligation to issue this notice, this basic idea of due process. This is when Section 3103 originated. It was published in the Federal Register, it was published in the Code of Federal Regulations, and it was binding on VA at the time of this decision. Insofar as the Manual M21 is inconsistent with it, the court should disregard it.
Counsel, are you suggesting that Mr. Fournier did not receive notice that was contained in a January 1969 decision from the RO?
No, Your Honor. We haven't challenged the adequacy of that decision.
Okay.
And he was given his appellate rights at that time.
Okay.
With regard to Section 19.110, which was discussed at some length, the Secretary points out that appellant hasn't challenged the validity of that regulation, but there's no reason to. All the Section 19.110 says that if appellate rights aren't issued, that failure will not extend the applicable period for filing an appeal. It's just a housekeeping rule that's issued to tell the board how to process appeals. The substantive rule is in Section 3.103. It says give notice, and it says what that notice is, which is what Mr. Fernier did not get in this case. Also, it could be pointed out that there was no regulation that said failure to give the reason for a decision would toll the period to file an appeal. And that's the central argument presented by appellant in this case. If the notice was inadequate for failure to give reason, then VA has nothing to fall back on in the nature of 19.110 to suggest that the decision would still be final if they hadn't complied with their own regulation.
Counsel, let me ask you a question I asked counsel for the Secretary as well. Did Mr. Fournier submit any communications to the Secretary after he received the decision in 1969 or 71?
No, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record between 1971 and 1980, and it's easy to see why. Because in October of 1971, the RO told him that VA would take no further action on his claim, and that it couldn't. The letter strongly implies that there is nothing the RO could do about this claim. So Mr. Fernier didn't come back until he was hospitalized in 1980. Essentially out of desperation did he come back to VA and say, I still have this problem that I have had since I was in the service.
So let me understand, had the 1971 letter indicated the specifics that are contained in 3.103A, you would not be here?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's the nub of the argument. The M21 provisions were added to the brief as further support for the idea that VA should have done more than it did. Insofar as those rules add to Section 3103, the court should enforce them because they are substantive rules in that they are strictly binding on what the RO does at the initial levels of adjudication.
Why are they substantive rules?
Because they narrowly bind the discretion of the RO at the early levels of adjudication.
How does that fit in with the... How would you analyze that? I mean, don't substantive rules have to affect... I mean, don't they have to affect the substantial rights of an individual?
They affect the right to notice under Section 3.103, which, broadly speaking, is the right to due process as VA read it at that time. So that's the substantive right that's being affected.
But 3.103, you said, I mean, that speaks directly to it. So why is the M21-1 provision a substantive rule? If you believe that 3.103 is binding, and because of notice and comment, as you told us, and that alone governs, then why do we even have to worry about the M21-1?
You would worry about it insofar as it expands the right created by Section 3.103. And arguably it does in this case, or at least it did as of what appellant produced on the principal brief in Section 46.02, because there's very broad language to the effect that if a claimant thinks anything on the record is related to service, that he gets a formal rating decision with his appellate rights. So I would look to the analysis in Cohen versus Brown, for example, to the effect that the M21 can expand on substantive rights granted by statute or by regulation, but it can't detract from them. It can't shrink them. So if the court were to find in this case that paragraph 27.07 provided less notice than is provided by regulation, then the court should disregard that paragraph. With regard to what Mr. Fernier was told in 1969 when his claim was initially denied, we haven't challenged the adequacy of that determination in any way, or the notice anyway of it. But the important point is that in 1971, VA required something different. It required new and material evidence. That's what he wasn't told. So, had he been told that, that would probably be enough to prevent an endless stream of duplicate claims that VA would have to respond to in a formal fashion over and over again.
Was he not told that in 1969?
He was told that his claim was denied, but the new material evidence standard is a different problem. And that's what he needed to be told in 1971 to understand how to reopen his claim.
Oh, in 69, he was denied VA benefits.
He was denied benefits for
individual personality. Did he get a notice at that time?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
But you're saying he received no notice at that time that in order to have this looked at again, you had to submit new evidence?
That I can't answer for sure, because I'm not sure what the appellate rights statement said at that time. Okay. But he was notified of appellate rights at that time.
Okay. And you're saying that notice was adequate, whatever it is?
Well, it was adequate to deny the initial claim at that time. But when
which
he came
would mean,
back...
Which would mean he was told everything that he needed to be told after that claim was adjudicated. In other words, they tell him no, that the notice letter contained everything, and that you're not challenging that.
Well, I don't recall the exact content of it.
Okay, well, let's assume it was it satisfied the 1971 requirements in their broadest sense. And he was told all of that in 1969. Then why is it that the VA can't just say in 1971, hey, we told you this stuff before, this is the same. Your claim is denied.
Because Section 3103 says if a claim is going to be disallowed, there are certain requirements for notice. That's the entire basis for the appeal.
And there was no regulation that, the 27-1 provision that, or 22-1 provision that talks in terms of duplicate claim does not purport to implement any particular regulation or statute. It's just that it's a duplicate claim?
Not by its own terms.
Okay.
The fair reading would be that it's an interpretation of VA's regulations, like 3.103.
That you don't adjudicate the claim, same claim over and over on the same facts.
That's right. Well, the idea...
And if you don't do that, if you receive a claim on the same facts that you've already decided, do you really receive it?
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's a new request for benefits. And if the manual M21 says in response to that new request, nothing will be done, then Your Honor would agree that that would be in conflict with 3.103, which says that some kind of notice has to be given and says what that notice would be.
There was a notice given, right?
Right. And in this case, the notice given was not adequate to satisfy the regulation.
Well,
and
the notice was because of statute, we cannot, as a matter of law, adjudicate this claim because it's on the same facts.
That's the impression given.
All right.
Or that it could never be granted at all, which is another way to read the letter.
Or that it could never be granted at all. Okay. Thank you. Any other? All right, the case is submitted. Court will greet counsel and adjourn.
All rise. Court is now in recess.